This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, last year's flu season was historically mild. That may not be the story this time around. A doctor explains what's coming up. Now, Wisconsin's top education official says public schools deserve investment, not arguments and divisiveness. Superintendent of Public Instruction Jill Underley gave her first State of Education address last week. She criticized Wisconsin's school funding system, saying it needs more backing at the state level. She said that doing so would also bring the people of the state together. Republicans pushed back on her calls for additional funding, saying it's never been better, and that's not counting federal pandemic aid. But there appears to be some agreement on creating a stronger civics curriculum. We talked to Superintendent Underley earlier today about those issues and more, including how schools are continuing to deal with COVID-19. Superintendent Underley, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me here. I'm excited to be here today.
For starters, you are calling for additional funding for Wisconsin schools. How much are you looking for?
Well, the thing is, the big picture here with school finance is that our schools didn't get an increase this year. So we received, you know, the federal money, which the legislature claims is enough. But when we look at it, the big picture here is that the funding that we received is designed for helping schools combat COVID. What we wanted was a per pupil increase at the very least. In the years past, it's been roughly, you know, $200 per child in our public schools. But we didn't get it. And so instead, schools are being asked to use the COVID money to make investments in long-term solutions. Again, it's just one-time money. And we have to look at it that the legislature knows that this is one-time money, and they're putting our kids in the middle of this. It's politics. You know, schools are dealing with so many financial stresses from the pandemic. That money was for those stresses and those immediate expenses. And our kids, again, are the ones that are going to be harmed because we didn't get that increase. And so in 2 years or a year and a half, our schools are going to have to make difficult decisions to either cut programs or staff.
I want to read from a statement from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, a Republican. Quote, "The Democrats' singular focus to push more money into schools isn't a winning strategy for our kids. We need to look at improving how they are being taught and why so many students are struggling with the basics, reading, writing, and arithmetic." So not just how much we're spending, but are we using it as best we can for those kids?
And that's where I just get frustrated because this stuff costs money. You know, assessments that, you know, Representative Voss is talking about cost money. Everything we do costs money. Expenses go up every year. And so, you know, being a teacher or an educator in Wisconsin isn't charity. I mean, it takes a level of knowledge and expertise. It's expensive work. And the programming is expensive. Having staff is expensive. And so we do need the funding. We need funding to keep up our buildings. Most Wisconsin school districts, need to upgrade their HVAC systems. And again, that costs money. Transportation costs money. So while we do have a myriad of issues that our schools are addressing, it still takes money to get those things done.
Outside of funding issues, what do you see as the biggest challenges facing schools in this, I can't say post-pandemic yet era, but as kids are back in school, as we're hopefully going to be emerging from the pandemic before too long?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there are lots of priorities, and they were issues before the pandemic. So we want to make sure that our schools have the resources that they need to provide the best education possible to our kids. We need to plan to focus time on issues like early childhood education, teacher recruitment and retention. We're losing teachers. We're not getting people going into the profession. And those who are in are not staying as long as they used to. We also have many issues around student mental health. And this, again, was an issue before the pandemic. And then, of course, as I addressed with school finance.
I mentioned a couple of the partisan differences between Republicans and Democrats on school spending. There's been a lot of partisanship related to the schools before the pandemic. Things have heated up in some ways, confrontations at school board meetings, superintendents in some cases let go over mask policies in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country. What would you like to see to make things a little more civil in our local education institutions?
Well, I think the civility starts with the adults, right? We shouldn't be attacking people. We should be talking about policies. Of course, a lot of it is personal, but again, we shouldn't be attacking each other over these things, because really who stands the most to lose are our kids, and it's the future of our state. Unfortunately, things are contentious. Things are very emotional. We shouldn't be directing that anger towards our school leaders or school board members or anyone for that matter who wants to lead. And again, we need to debate the policies. I mean, we can disagree about policies, but that certainly, that discussion that comes out of those disagreements is what makes good policy. We need to make sure that voices are involved in how policies are crafted. And generally, we get to consensus. We may not be entirely 100% happy with the outcome, but we can make sure then that everybody's voice was heard and that the end product or the end policy is what's best for us.
We're talking to Wisconsin Superintendent of Public Instruction Jill Underle after her State of Education address last week, looking at some of the big issues facing Wisconsin schools. Superintendent Underle, you looked at what is sometimes called an achievement gap, a racial achievement gap or outcome gap in Wisconsin. You don't like those labels even. Can you talk about what you like to think of it as?
I've talked about this enough where I hope people are catching on that when we talk about achievement gaps, we look at the reasons why there's differences in literacy scores or math scores. It's generally related to poverty. And we need to make sure then that at the end of the day, it's the opportunities that we are offering kids that tell us their trajectory of success. We need to make sure that we have high quality early childhood programming. We need to make sure that the best and brightest teachers are in front of all of our kids. We need to make sure that all our kids have access to mental health and, you know, healthcare and all these different things that go into making sure our kids are prepared to learn. Finance is another part of that too. When you go from district to school district, you can tell which school districts have the best opportunities for their kids and which schools are just scraping by. And it's not to disparage those school districts that don't have as many opportunities, because they're doing the best that they can. But if we want all kids in Wisconsin to be successful, we need to make sure that they all have adequate opportunity and that we can even that out, because that's what equity is about.
Assembly Republicans are planning to take up a bunch of legislation this week related to K through 12 schools. One would effectively ban what they're labeling as critical race theory in schools, some of the specifics prohibiting teaching that one race or gender is inherently superior to another, or that someone is inherently racist, sexist, or oppressive just because they happen to be of a certain race or gender. A couple of the items on their list there. What are you thinking of that effort in the Assembly?
Well, I mean, I think my first response is that I'm surprised and both unsurprised by the fact that it keeps coming up. But it's also the bigger picture here is that we have a legislature that wants to micromanage what our school districts are teaching kids. They want to micromanage the content in our curriculum. They want to micromanage, you know, how we can spend our funding to make sure that we're meeting the needs of all kids. So as far as critical race theory is concerned, I'm surprised that people haven't taken the time to learn what it really is. And critical race theory, again, it's an academic lens that looks at our history, one that is generally confined to higher education. It looks at the origins of things through a lens of racism. On the other hand, you know, like I said, I'm not surprised that this question keeps coming up, because it's an example of how we're just constantly being wedged apart. CRT is not being taught in our schools, at least in the way that those who use it to instill fear think it's being taught. Rather, what I want people to realize is that we teach minority history and we teach current events, and that is not critical race theory. And again, no type of learning should ever be abolished. I mean, this is a great example of why it's important to reinforce what many of our students already know, that we need to think critically and verify our sources of information.
Lawmakers also looking at a civics curriculum requirement. And in your address, you talked about the importance of Wisconsin's civics education curriculum. You might be coming at it from different angles, but do you see room for common ground between yourself and legislative Republicans on civics instruction?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think the legislation has some positive ideas. Certainly getting a civil discourse around civics and how we can strengthen instruction in our schools is important. But what I disagree with is that top-down, again, that micromanaging approach by the legislature. you know, our school districts have the authority to, and certainly the legislature can pass the policies, and my job is to execute them, you know, as the member of the executive branch. And certainly if we had a civics requirement, I would be in favor of that. What I'm not, again, in favor is, you know, them deciding what the content is going to be and having it controlled by our rules committee.
As we wrap up, what are your hopes for this current school year?
Well, I think the first thing, you know, is certainly just, again, focusing again on what matters, right? At the end of the day, it's like, we want to make sure that our kids are safe, that they're well-educated, and we need to make sure that there is support for our school districts. I'm so worried that all of these issues that are coming through the legislature are intended to divide our communities and distract them from the larger issue at hand, which is making sure that our kids are safe and that we can get through this pandemic. And again, it's not the fault of our school districts that we are still in this pandemic. We're just doing the best that we can to make sure that we can educate kids and do so in the safest way possible.
Superintendent Underly, thanks again for joining us today.
You bet, Rob. Thank you.
That's Jill Underly, Wisconsin State Superintendent of Public Instruction. I talked to her earlier today about her first State of Education address for Wisconsin and her priorities for public schools in the state. You can let us know what you think of what Superintendent Underly had to say at 800-642-1234. What do you think is the most important issue facing schools today? Do you want to see the state spend more on schools? Do you want to see local spending go up or down? Do you have a concern on what and how material is being taught? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
On the Ideas Network, you're invited to be part of the conversation. When you call our talk shows, you play an important role. If you have a question or comment, we want to hear it. Be part of the conversation and check out our caller guidelines at WPR.org/guidelines.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about issues facing public schools here in Wisconsin. We just heard from State Superintendent Jill Underly about her State of Education address last week. She called for more funding from the state for K-12 schools, a civics requirement for high school students, and a literacy task force. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's on your wish list for Wisconsin's public schools? What is the state of your local district, whether you are a parent, student, a teacher, staff member, or concerned community member? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Now for some analysis on what Superintendent Underly had to say, Alan Borsick is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School and an education columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Alan, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Well, we hear from the superintendent saying, hey, the schools need more investment from the state. Leading Republican lawmakers saying, hey, we've got a lot of money going in, plus federal relief money going to schools. That's not the problem. What's your read, Alan, on the current state of school funding in Wisconsin?
Well, a lot depends on how you assess that federal money. And even that isn't quite so helpful to schools because it's weighted to poverty. So districts that don't have much poverty aren't getting much federal money and getting no increase in the revenue cap, the per student state and local aid, means that they're facing difficult problems, primarily in the middle class and above districts. A district like MPS is going to get that federal money. On the other hand, it is short-term money. A lot of it is committed to physical improvements in the schools, air conditioning and air quality, and who knows what. So I don't think anybody's rolling in any money on the school side. I'm having trouble paying attention to all of these legislative and general capital debates because there's so little cooperation and so little's going to come out of them. The governor proposes something, you know, the Republicans aren't going to do it. The Republicans propose something, you know, the governor's going to veto it. It's just like they're engaged in some strange theatric ritual that isn't really going to produce anything at a time we really need to be concerned about how kids are doing in school.
Is this the way it's always been, Alan, or is it, I think, worse now when it comes to this partisan standoff over what we do with our schools?
Well, it's always been highly partisan, but it's definitely worse now. And there were times when it wasn't so bad. Tommy Thompson, who's now the head of the UW system, when he was governor, he liked the Big Ten. He liked to bring the Democrats on board, and sometimes he did, with some fairly big ideas. But we live in just extraordinarily polarized and hyper-partisan times. And yes, I think objectively it's worse now.
Staying with school funding for a moment, we have that two-thirds commitment saying the state money is going to cover two-thirds of costs at schools. You locals, you do the rest, mostly with property taxes. Is that still happening? Is the state still reaching that level of funding?
Well, yes. In the budget, which amazingly enough, the legislature did come up with a budget and the governor signed it, but it was kind of a strange document in some ways. It did go back to two-thirds funding, but then the question is, how big a pie is it? If I'm going to give you two-thirds of the pie, and it's a small pie, it's not that much pie. If it's a big pie, then it's a bigger piece of pie. So it's two-thirds, but it's not what school people want.
And we see in a lot of cases, local school referenda passing many times, 90%, I think, in 2020. Does that suggest to you that, hey, in these districts, the pie wasn't big enough to begin with?
For sure. And in many cases, for a while, I was fairly certain that it could be said that higher income districts, wealthier districts, were benefiting from this the most because that's where people were going to vote to increase school spending. There have been exceptions to that, most notably that Milwaukee passed by an overwhelming margin, a school funding referendum in the spring of 2020. So sometimes that isn't true, but nonetheless, it's kind of a short-term thinking way of solving school funding problems.
We're talking about the state of education in Wisconsin. Alan Borsig is with us from the Marquette University Law School, a fellow in law and public policy there, education columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Philip is with us in Neenah. Philip, hello.
Hi. I just had a quick question about how federal aid fits into the school budget this year. I thought there was some controversy about how the federal government required states not to reduce their budgetary contributions to the state budget as a result of the one-time federal aid. Is that still a problem with the budget proposal this year?
Philip, interesting question. So the idea that you're not supposed to use the federal COVID relief money to backfill local or state cuts, Alan, how has that worked out?
Well, it worked out. Again, I can't say that with a whole lot of enthusiasm. The Republicans' initial proposal didn't continue this what's called maintenance of effort. And so they put a lot of money kind of into a set aside fund, maybe for schools that, and also a lot of money into what's labeled school support, but is actually property tax relief. It does not go to schools at all. It goes to property tax relief in local communities. So they came up with enough money for education that it meets the federal maintenance of effort standards. But it didn't really increase school spending. You know, that's kind of sounds like a contradictory statement, but that's the way it really is.
Philip, thanks a lot for calling in with that question. Turning away from the money side of things, Alan, a big concern, of course, with the pandemic and schools, a lot of remote learning, how much learning loss there was for students. How much did kids fall behind where they hoped they were? What do we know about that? How are people trying to even measure that?
Well, the data isn't very strong for Wisconsin, but test results from last year, I believe, are going to be released maybe like in early November, and those will tell a lot. The indications nationwide are that districts that where kids were in virtual learning for most or almost all of the school year, the kids did not make very much progress. Ones where kids were in school, they may have been running a lot more health threats, but they were getting more schooling. Milwaukee, I think, is a really strong example of a school district that really didn't have school hardly till just near the end of the school year. My guess, and I've heard some suggestions from people who I think know, is that the Milwaukee scores this year are going to be very concerning. That's an understatement, probably. And that's, of course, the neediest, shall we say, school district in the state. So overall, learning at home, virtual learning didn't work well as a way of learning. You know, schools were caught and are still caught between this rock and a hard place on health versus learning, and no one's really good at navigating that.
All right, Alan, thought exercise for you. Thought exercise for you in our last minute or so here. If I could put you in a room or a Zoom meeting with leading Republicans and Democrats involved in education policy, what would you tell them, plead with them to focus on as a number one priority for Wisconsin schools?
Well, to work together and to really focus on kids. The Blue Ribbon Task Force that was created by Republicans in the Assembly, 3 years ago, had a number of fairly bipartisan resolutions, recommendations, but it almost went almost nowhere. My suggestion sometimes has been lock the door, tell the people inside, the good news is I have an unlimited budget for pizza. The bad news is you're not coming out till you all agree on something.
Good place to leave it, Alan. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Glad to be here.
That's Alan Vorsek, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School and an education columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Earlier, we talked to Wisconsin State Superintendent of Public Instruction Jill Underley about school funding, COVID, civics, and her first ever State of Education address. Still time to share your thoughts, your hopes, and or fears for schools in Wisconsin. You can email ideas@WPR.org. And of course, you can always tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Coming up, an infectious disease specialist tells us what to expect in our second flu season during the COVID pandemic. One slight bit of good news from last year, a very mild flu season. Is that going to be the case again? We'll look at the latest forecasts. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new documentary series puts the spotlight on multi-level marketing companies. We'll talk about what they are and the financial risks they can pose to the people they target. Now, with the start of fall comes the start of flu season. Last season, there were historically low numbers of confirmed flu cases, as well as flu-related hospitalizations and deaths. The drop was in large part because of public health precautions in place to prevent the spread of COVID-19. That may be unlikely to happen again this year as a lot of society has reopened. Dr. James Conway is Associate Director for Health Sciences at UW-Madison's Global Health Institute. He's an expert in pediatric infectious disease. Dr. Conway, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back, Rob.
Can you first of all talk about that big absence of flu last year, one tiny bit of good news amidst, of course, the bad news about COVID last year?
Yeah, it was a really pleasant surprise that the combination of travel restrictions, schools being closed, and people being very careful about their secretions and who they were around really showed us that we actually could prevent most of the cold and flu season.
Is that likely to happen again this year, though, do you think?
No, I think it's unlikely. We've actually already seen glimmers of the other side of this. You know, even with the limited opening of society, we've had a really early resurgence of a virus called respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, which has already showed up, usually shows up, you know, November, December, very predictably in Wisconsin. And we've already had a surge of that in July and August. So I think we're already seeing that by just lifting even some of these measures, respiratory viruses are going to be back.
And a quick reminder, influenza, I kind of do a disclaimer every time. People sometimes think flu equals stomach flu. Influenza that we're talking about, respiratory virus, right?
Absolutely. Actually, very similar to coronaviruses in that they're upper respiratory primarily, and then they can cause lower respiratory tract disease. So they cause pneumonias, and that's really what does people in for the, you know, 20, 30, 40,000 people that die every year from influenza during a normal season. They die from a primarily respiratory compromise.
Having had a mild influenza season, and most of us therefore probably not exposed to flu virus, does that put us at any more of the risk of a risk this year or down the road?
Yeah, it does. I mean, on an average year, somewhere between 40 and 45% of people get a flu vaccine, and then depending on the year, I mean, we see, you know, 20 or 30 million infections. So that's about a tenth of the population. And so we get, you know, some herd immunity of 10 or 20% every year. And that carries over into the next year. We had, you know, essentially no influenza, as you mentioned. So we're really going to be depending on just the vaccine immunity this year, trying to prevent too much spread.
Who should get a flu shot?
Well, I mean, pretty much everybody over 6 months of age is eligible for a flu shot. I think the key groups, people that really need to make sure that they're immunized, are the older individuals, folks over age 65, people with comorbidities, people with underlying immune deficiencies and respiratory illnesses. Really the same group that we prioritized early on with the COVID-19 vaccines are really the high priority group. But we really recommend everybody get this vaccine, the same as we recommend everybody that's eligible get the COVID vaccine, because you're getting it not only to protect yourself, and these are unpredictable viruses, so while most people do okay if they're healthy with most of these viruses, some don't. And so we want people to get protected themselves, but we also want them to be able to then protect their loved ones and others that they're around and not transmit to them. And so it's sort of two for the price of one if you get your flu vaccine.
How dangerous has flu been in recent years, especially compared to something horrific like COVID?
Yeah, we've had some pretty nasty years, and I think it's, you know, only by virtue of how terrible COVID has been that people forget that 2019, 2020 was actually one of our worst flu seasons in some years. I mean, we pushed over 60,000 deaths in the United States from flu that year. Hospitals were really at capacity, and only when COVID showed up, I think, did it suddenly erase the memory of that flu season. But we've had some pretty bad ones. And then don't forget, we had a pandemic in 2009 with flu A H1N1 that really swept across the globe. So influenza is a bad actor. It's a lot like these coronaviruses. They're unpredictable. They mutate frequently. And so we do need to keep an eye out for them.
Can you talk about the vaccine and how it's set up? I understand now it used to be three strains. Now it's got four strains it's trying to protect us from. How do health experts try to figure out which strains are most likely and therefore which ones to tailor vaccines for?
Yeah, usually the way it works is that we look at what's been circulating in the other hemisphere. So in our winter and then summer in the southern hemisphere, each looks at the other one to see basically what's been circulating. And that helps predict what's going to be circulating in the coming winter. This year, obviously, we don't have a lot to go on because the social lockdown and mitigation programs in both sides of the globe have really shut down influenza across the board. And so it's really been sort of an educated guess. And essentially the vaccines are made up of the same strains that were used in the 2019-2020 season with a few minor alterations. But yeah, there's four strains now. So there's both of the flu B strains, and then they select two of the high risk A strains. So usually it's an H1N1. And then this year, I think it's an H3N2. But every year they really have to kind of make a good guess. You know, the good thing about flu vaccines is, although they may not be completely protective and you do see breakthrough cases, they certainly are very good at protecting against serious disease, hospitalization, and death, even if the guess isn't quite right. There's cross-protection that usually does carry most people through as long as they're vaccinated.
Last year, I heard the case that getting the flu vaccine can help our public health system strained by COVID. So the influenza vaccine doesn't do anything for COVID directly, but it might keep people out of hospitals already strained by COVID-19 cases. Is that something you're watching for again this year?
Yeah, that's actually even a bigger impetus this year than it was last year. I think last year we asked people to do it because we just didn't know what to predict for any of these things. And it turned out that our mitigation really did control flu. Obviously, society is much more open, travel is back, and people are back to interacting. And so we're really nervous given the really full hospital capacity we're at in many areas of the state, that if you superimpose even a moderate flu vaccine, a moderate flu season on top of this ongoing Delta variant or whatever the next variant is, and we really could be in a world of hurt. So that's the idea, is really to try to protect society, protect the hospitals, protect the outpatient clinics so that we can manage whatever capacity we've got for other diseases as well.
As we wrap up, let's talk timing of the vaccine. I used to think that, oh, if I get the flu vaccine too early in the season, it won't protect me anymore at the end of the season. I believe I was wrong.
You were wrong at some level because you're a young, healthy guy. But, you know, the CDC has actually kind of made some statements recently that for older individuals, you know, they should hold off on getting it in July and August, because vaccine is actually available in a lot of areas of the country as early as August. So too early is basically July, August for that population. Everybody else, vaccines are fully available now, and I encourage everybody to get them. You know, while flu season typically sort of starts up around the holidays and kind of goes through the winter, we've had a couple of years in the last 20 years where it did show up as early October. And we just don't know what to predict this year. And again, anything we can do to both protect our families and our loved ones and keep our hospital and clinic capacity able to manage the rest of these things that are happening, I think would do us all some benefit.
Dr. Conway, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Have a great day.
You too. That's Dr. James Conway, Associate Director for Health Sciences at UW-Madison's Global Health Institute and a pediatric infectious disease expert. He talked to us about flu season. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about a musical family.
For the members of Tomahawk Circle, playing in a rural family band is a labor of love. This Lac-de-Flambeau Ojibwe drum group crisscrosses the country most years to share their music with an extended community of Indigenous people. At powwows from Washington State to North Carolina, members of Tomahawk Circle surround a single animal hide drum and belt out songs in the Northern original style. Joe O'Connell with Chippewa Valley Museum's Sounds Like Home podcast brings us their story.
Good road music, too, when you're on traveling on a road, 20, 30-hour drives. I'm used to it. All right, my name is William Mitchell Jr. I am from Lac-de-Flambeau, Tomahawk Circle. We're like all family, legit brothers.
My name's Henry Mitchell, a singer, part of the drum.
We're brothers here. Yeah, and this is my dad.
My name's William Mitchell Sr., and I'm just a singer and a drum.
So he's my dad.
Blake Wanape, just a singer.
Like, he's my cousin.
I'm Wilbur Mitchell.
And that's his nephew.
I'm just a singer as well.
I am the drum master, lead singer. Started this group back in 2006 when these guys were just young. There's apartment buildings not too far from where we're at, just down the road. We all grew up on it. It's the street name is Tomahawk Circle, so that's where we got our name because we all lived within walking distance of each other back in the day when these guys were little kids. We all get together, there's at least 10 of us. That's a good amount of singers. But then if you're short on singers, like we travel, so we got like drum brothers they're called.
I'm not originally from here, I'm from Cushino, Wisconsin. I'm an Omni, and they just picked me up because I knew I could sing. So now I travel around with Tomahawk Circle.
And they're willing to help out or want to sing and stuff, so. Every pub we go to, we're pretty crewed up.
We usually go to like big contest powwows, all the way from east to west coast.
It's kind of like our summer grind.
We performed in California, Connecticut, Ann Arbor, Michigan, all the way up to New York, Florida, went up to Saskatchewan, Arizona, North Carolina, Alabama, from the state of Washington all the way to east coast of New York. So we're pretty busy, you know, we try to stay busy.
Well, there's competition singing and traditional singing. Competition singing, everything's got to be perfect. You sing good, you know, you get good scores, and hopefully we do good in the contest. If we get lucky, sometimes we take home a little extra cash. Sometimes it just pays for the trip.
What money we make, we probably spend that to get there, you know, we just go represent and have a good time. And we've been there and done it, you know, that's all we can say, you know. As long as we make it back home in one piece like we came, we're good to go to the next one.
In the end, it's definitely experience and seeing, like you mentioned, our drum bros or, you know, family from across the country. You know, it's a celebration of life. Everybody gets together. You know, they sing their songs, everybody dances. And if they're hearing good music,
yeah,
you know, they
no
feel...
Oh, unless there's a drum. Get those dancers out there rocking, you hear those bells. Man, it's a good feeling. Yep, it's a good feeling.
That story about Tomahawk Circle was produced by Joe O'Connell. Portions of the music you heard come from the Tomahawk Circle CD, Just Beginning. Make sure to check out the Sounds Like Home podcast from Chippewa Valley Museum to hear a longer version of that story and more features on regional music. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, we'll take a look at the new documentary series Lula Rich and what it tells us about the line between multi-level marketing companies and pyramid schemes. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The new Amazon documentary series Lula Rich tells the story of LuLaRoe, a multi-level marketing company that sells women's clothes to people who then turn around and sell those clothes to customers. LuLaRoe saw huge growth in the 2010s, but some allege the company is actually a pyramid scheme that makes most of its money by recruiting people who pay thousands of dollars up front to become LuLaRoe sellers. Our next guest says consumers should be careful before getting into multi-level marketing businesses and has some advice on what to watch out for. Christine Whelan is a clinical professor of consumer science at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. Christine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Give us the basics, please, Christine. What are multi-level marketing companies?
So multi-level marketing companies are companies where you yourself are selling a product direct to consumers, but you're also recruiting people to sell underneath you. And the more people that you have working for you, you get bonuses off of their sales as well. So multi-level marketing companies are legal, whereas pyramid schemes are not. And the difference between those two really is, do you make most of your money off of recruiting people, or do you make most of your money off of selling products? So this is where LuLaRoe got into some trouble.
What is it that, at least in this documentary, makes it look like LuLaRoe may have crossed that line from legitimate multi-level marketing to maybe a pyramid scheme?
The bonuses that some members of the LuLaRoe empire were receiving were $90,000, sometimes even $100,000 a month. And those huge bonuses were not coming from the sale of leggings and t-shirts. Those were coming from the fact that the people up at the top of the pyramid scheme had dozens, hundreds, even thousands of people who were buying in to the LuLaRoe empire, buying stock of $5,000 to $10,000 of merchandise and then trying to sell it. So this is where multi-level marketing becomes a pyramid scheme and becomes something that is going to be illegal.
I want to listen to how LuLaRoe talked about people who were critical of them. This is a clip from that series. Mark Stidham here, one of the founders of the company, talking on a call to LuLaRoe sellers. Here's a listen.
Don't put up with people who detract from our culture. If we're going to maintain the culture strong, the sooner that truth comes out, the sooner they can either make a decision to align or to leave.
And in the documentary, LuLaRoe sellers describe a culture of you're with us or you're against us. Is that a common theme in multi-level marketing companies?
It is. And, you know, this is where some people would say it heads into cult status, because the relentlessly positive attitude of, you know, if you work hard enough, you can sell, be an entrepreneur, be a small business owner in your own home. All these sort of messages of mostly female empowerment that were actually hurting women rather than helping them. And what we see with LuLaRoe is that the bottom 70% were not making money. In fact, they were losing money, whereas the people up at the top of the pyramid, they were the ones who were cashing in. So these positive messages that are really selling people a bill of goods in terms of what their future success is going to be like if they make an investment in the company.
Talking to Christine Whelan from the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, looking at multi-level marketing companies, pyramid schemes, what the line is between them, looking at the new Amazon Prime docuseries, Lula Rich. Christine, I want to flip things around and look at this, if you will, through the eyes of a prospective seller for one of these companies, probably a woman, as you said. Maybe their neighbor or friend is making that pitch to get them on board to make that initial buy-in. What kind of things should that person be weighing as they decide whether this is worth the risk?
The big question is, you know, does it look too good to be true? Because if it does, it probably is. So when women were making $10,000 investments buying leggings. The idea was that they were buying them at $10 a legging and they were going to sell them at $25 a legging, making $15 profit each time over and over, and then they could really make hundreds of thousands of dollars. The challenge was, though, that they did not get a choice in terms of what leggings to order, and they were going to be asked to sell anything that came to them. If they were not successful in their sales, they were told it's their fault. So anytime you have a company that is saying, you know, it's all on you and we're not, we're only offering encouragement, then that's something to be a little concerned about.
A big concern seems to be, again, that line between business and pyramid scheme. If most of the money appears to be coming from recruiting other salespeople as opposed to just selling the product to people, is that a big red flag?
It is. And that really is the biggest red flag. And that's, again, when you go into a pyramid scheme. So if you are being encouraged to look the part, to look like you are affluent so that other people want to come join the company and come under you, if you are really seeing your salary and bonuses coming from other people's buy-in rather than from your own sales, that's when things become very, very suspicious. And when we see this, especially with women who are trying to balance family life and earn some money as well, you know, we really see that this company was preying on the vulnerable and taking advantage of women who wanted to work and also wanted to be with their family.
Do you see multi-level marketing companies that you think get it right, that are not just on the right side of the law, but can be reasonable investments of time and other resources for people to get involved in?
So certainly there are all sorts of companies that have been incredibly successful. In fact, companies like Amway have been so successful that you don't even know what products are owned by them anymore. So there are these companies that are out there that have done it legally and potentially have done it well. If you're a person who is interested in getting involved in one of these companies, you have to be willing to sell to your friends. You have to be willing to cross that line of business and personal friendship. And for many people, that's a little bit uncomfortable. The opportunities, though, seem really promising for many people, especially when we're telling women that they need to be in charge of everything in the home. And so if you are limited in terms of the hours you can work outside the home, this can seem like a very good deal.
That's one thing that always concerned me about this is that you have to take your personal relationships with friends and family and instrumentalize them, business them up. Do we lose something, you think, when that happens?
Yes, and I think that, you know, a lot of people listening might say, oh, that's really cringeworthy. I would never want to do that. But that actually is a statement that would come from a position of some privilege, right?
Mm-hmm,
because
right.
If you are struggling to make ends meet, then you need to make a couple hundred dollars, however you can. And this is how these multi-level marketing schemes get people involved.
In just our last minute or so, are there efforts to change the laws around multi-level marketing companies to make it clear what is allowed and what isn't okay?
So there are whistleblowers who are looking at all the multi-level marketing companies and who are keeping an eye on things and when things turn into pyramid schemes. These companies fly below the radar a lot of the time, and so they can be hard to look at until they get big. In the case of LuLaRich, it got so big, LuLaRoe got so big that the LuLaRich documentary certainly captures how they had a rise and a fall. So it's a sort of buyer beware for all of these things, and it's interesting to learn more about it so we can all be savvier consumers.
Christine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Christine Whelan. She's a clinical professor of consumer science at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. She was with us today for a look at multi-level marketing companies and the new Amazon docuseries LuLaRich, looking at the company LuLaRoe. And let us know if you've had an experience, good or bad, with one of these companies. If you've watched this documentary, you can tell us what you think. Email ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. It's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, a Wisconsin community has a new plan to help people dealing with non-violent mental health emergencies. Find out more on how it works tomorrow at 7:30 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then our guest says we need to take a bigger view of our relationship with fire. But to live with the year-in, year-out bad fire seasons we're experiencing, there's more we need to understand about our relationship with the chemical reaction we call fire. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.